Join us now for the Chapel Hour, coming to you from the campus of Bob Jones University. Our speaker is Dr. Ken Casillas of the BJU Seminary faculty. The title of his message is Contrasting Responses to Jesus Christ. The text is from Mark 14, verses 1 through 11.
Today I'd like to invite you to go with me to Mark, the Gospel of Mark, chapter 14. Mark chapter 14. And in just a moment, I'd like to read the first 11 verses from this chapter, Mark 14. We're just about 3 weeks into 2009, and I'm sure that, like me, you have done some reflecting on whatever happened in your life during the last year. Maybe some of those things were memorable and exciting. Maybe others were difficult, but you're thankful to look back and see how God has sustained you. For me and my family, this past year has brought a lot of changes and memorable experiences and new opportunities and responsibilities. But I'm thankful as well for some of the lighter and more enjoyable things along the way. As I think back on 2008, one of those lighter things is that for us as a family, it was kind of the year of Tolkien for us. And that's because we kind of started, I can't remember exactly when, but to listen to audio recordings of the Lord of the Rings trilogy. We have about a half hour drive to church. And so a lot of times coming back on a Sunday night or a Wednesday night, we'd put the CD on and really had a delightful time. Getting more familiar with the characters and the story, and actually started with The Hobbit and listened to the three in the trilogy. It was very enjoyable, but it was also a little frustrating because of the way we were doing it, so chopped up and just about, you know, a half hour here, a half hour there, and easy to lose a sense of the continuity. And it was also frustrating because you might remember, if you've read those books, that there are a lot of on the edge of your seat kind of moments where you're not sure what's going to happen next. And seemed like often we would be pulling into the driveway. Everybody's tired. It's late at night. Got to go to school the next day. And Bilbo is surrounded by yet another horde of hideous beasts that are ready to kill him. And so we decide to just sit in the car and wait till the next track or see what's going to happen. Or Frodo is hanging off the side of another cliff, and we got to sit there for 5 minutes and make sure that he's going to be okay for the next day. So we had a lot of times like that. Probably the most frustrating was at the end, if I remember all my facts, it was at the end of the second one, the Two Towers. And Frodo had just gotten stung, had gotten attacked by Shelob, the big spider thing. And Sam thinks that he is dead, that he is gone. And so he really struggles with what to do. He takes the ring from him. He walks away. And eventually the orcs come by. And while Sam is away, they whisk away his friend. And Sam doesn't know what's going on or where they're taking him. And quickly he finds out that actually Frodo isn't dead. He'd just been stung temporarily. But he is out of his reach. There's nothing he can do. And the book ends, the story there ends, with Sam at the door of this tower thing and wanting to do something to save the life of his master and really worried and unsure what's going to happen next. Really leaves you in suspense. So you get the next CD and you're very frustrated to find out that the story doesn't continue. But the author picks up with a whole other part and he starts talking about Gandalf and Pippin going off to war at Minas Tirith or something. And it just goes on forever, chapter after chapter, before you come back and find out what's going on with Frodo, if he's going to survive and what's going to happen with the ring. Well, a good author knows how to set things up suspensefully to keep you interested like that, to keep you reading. A lot of times that kind of combination of plots with delays in telling you what happened with one of the other plots is a way to weave things together in order to get across a point. Because, in fact, the different plots connect with each other. They have a lot to do with each other. And it's all one story. You really do need all the pieces of the puzzle to keep it all together. The Bible is literature. God chose to use the devices of good human literature to give us His revelation. I think one of the things that we often miss and that robs us of understanding and robs us of spiritual teaching is that we're not reading the Bible as though it were literature. We read it perhaps just to get our assignment done. We read it perhaps to fulfill an obligation of getting through so many chapters in a day. We perhaps are looking for some statement to jump off the page at us and encourage us, but we fail to look carefully at how these narrative portions particularly are put together, and we miss a lot of what is there. When we come to the Gospel of Mark, what you find is that actually there is a lot of that intertwining of plots going on. And Mark, of all the Gospel writers, is especially known for what are called intercalations. That is, the author begins to tell you one story, but he drops it off, does not bring it to closure, and begins into another story right in the middle of the first one. And it's not perhaps for another half chapter that you return to the original story and find out what all happened and what's the significance of all this. Those kinds of what's been called literary sandwiches, these two stories packaged up together with one of them embedded in the middle of another, is supposed to invite you as the reader to begin asking questions. Why are these two stories combined? Why are they put together in this way? You're supposed to be thinking, how are these people or how are these events similar? What are the contrasts between them? And keep that in mind as I read for you now from the Gospel of Mark, chapter 14. This is, of course, the beginning of the Passion narratives. And we read this in verse 1. After 2 days was the feast of the Passover and of the unleavened bread. And the chief priests and the scribes sought how they might take him, that is, Jesus, by craft and put him to death. But they said, not on the feast day, lest there be an uproar of the people. Now, we know what happens because we're familiar with the basic storyline of the New Testament. But as far as Mark's concerned, the story is left hanging. He's not going to tell you yet what these men do. He's going to jump to another scene. Verse 3. And being in Bethany in the house of Simon the leper, as he sat at meat, there came a woman having an alabaster box of ointment of spikenard, very precious. And she brake the box and poured it on his head. And there were some that had indignation within themselves and said, why was this waste of the ointment made? For it might have been sold for more than 300 pence and have been given to the poor. And they murmured against her. And Jesus said, let her alone. Why trouble ye her? She hath wrought a good work on me. For ye have the poor with you always, and whensoever ye will, ye may do them good. But me ye have not always. She hath done what she could. She is come aforehand to anoint my body to the bearing. Verily I say unto you, wheresoever this gospel shall be preached throughout the whole world, this also that she hath done shall be spoken of for a memorial of her. And that is the end of that incident. And now we're back to the first story. And here's how it wraps up. Judas Iscariot, one of the 12, went unto the chief priests that had been mentioned at the beginning to betray Jesus unto them. And when they heard it, they were glad and promised to give him money. And he sought how he might conveniently betray him. Now, these two stories are put together to invite, I believe, a comparison, a contrast between two possible responses to Jesus Christ. And as Mark in his gospel throughout the book is talking about discipleship, these are the two possibilities that are before us. We want to walk through this passage a little more inductively maybe than in most sermons and try along the way to arrive at what the lesson is for us about discipleship and what it is that God would have us do in response to the Lord Jesus. I think as we put these two stories side by side, first of all, we see that they are different in their origin. They come from different sources. And the source reflects, ironically, upon the kind of response that's being given. Where is the response, first of all, of betrayal come from? Well, you look down at verse 1 and you find that you're dealing there with the chief priest and with the scribes. I mean, it seems like of all people, the religious leaders, the people that were most steeped in the Old Testament and its prediction about the Lord's plan to send his Messiah, it seems that of all people, they would have the insight to recognize the hand of God on Jesus' life. But it is from that source that the betrayal comes. It gets even more poignant as you look down at the end of the passage. And Judas Iscariot, who made this all possible on the human level, is described as one of the 12. Not just religious leaders on the outside, but somebody from the inside is raising up against his master and he's delivering him over to the enemy. This certainly is not uncommon in the Bible that throughout Scripture and throughout history after the Bible, it's the religious leadership, the official religious leadership, and often those who would seem to have the greatest reputation for wisdom and for godliness end up being the ones that most disappoint us because they end up acting so contrary to the message that they have been known to preach and to proclaim. Apostle Paul said that often it is those who are giving the appearance of being ministers of light that end up actually, when the mask is taken off in the time of God, end up being the servants of Satan. And that certainly means, as we have heard this week a couple of times, that as disciples of Christ, we ought to be evaluating what's going on in the world of religion and not take everything at face value and discern according to Scripture. That's all true, but I think we shouldn't stop there. As we look at this story, what it does is to compel us to consider that my response to Jesus is not at all guaranteed by any position of spiritual leadership that I may have. And the fact that others may look up to me for a walk with God, the fact that I may have some official position and be actually a spokesman for the Lord in some sense, that means nothing. It is no guarantee in terms of actual discipleship. It may be that I'm actually a betrayer. Well, what's the origin of the other response, which was not an act of betrayal, but it is an act of devotion? Verse 3 tells us that that devotion had its source in a woman, which may not mean too much to us, may not seem unusual, but the fact is that in that society, women had a pretty low position socially. And in the kind of banquet that you're reading about in this chapter, it was not common for women to just walk up and enter into a conversation or get involved. It was typically the men who were sitting, and the women, if they were there, were serving the food. This woman, in her act of devotion, approaches the Lord, and we read about the great act of sacrifice and worship that she takes part in. Actually, for Mark, this is not the only woman that is presented as a model of discipleship. In another one of those little sandwiches of stories, you have a story of Jairus, whose daughter is on the verge of death, and that one is interrupted with a woman who runs up to Christ and touches the hem of his garment in chapter 5. And she is lifted up because of her boldness in believing that Jesus could heal her. And she ends up being an example, an inspiration to Jairus to continue trusting in this Jesus, even though he has gotten bad news about his daughter. There's another woman. Chapter 12 tells us about her. And she is contrasted with the religious leaders once again, and all these wealthy people going by, putting these great gifts into the offering, she puts in her two mites, her insignificant offering. And what does the Lord do? He lifts her up as a model of devotion, as a model of discipleship. That whole idea of insignificant people being the example is communicated as well by the fact that this whole incident took place in the house of somebody called Simon the leper. Verse 3 gives us his name. We don't really know anything about him, but seems to be that this man had been a leper previously. He wouldn't really be hosting people in his home in that condition, that he'd been delivered from leprosy by Christ. And yet he continued to be associated with that former sickness that had such a stigma. And it is suggestive of the mercy of Christ on somebody rejected by society once again, somebody on the outside. And this is the individual who is welcoming Jesus, and he's saying, let's have a meal in my home. I'm so thankful for what the Apostle Paul said in 1 Corinthians, that it is not many mighty or many noble or many wise that God has called, but God in his grace has chosen the weak things of the world, the base things, the things that are nothing, in order to confound the great ones of the earth. Isn't that encouragement to you as you consider what we're going to see next about the difficulties sometimes in discipleship? That all of this began when Jesus chose to have mercy on you, a nobody. And it is people like you throughout the Bible that are lifted up as examples of what it means to follow Christ. We've talked about the origin of these responses, but we see secondly that they're also different in their motive. That is, what was going on in the hearts of these people that brought forth this response? Clearly, as we come to the chief priest and the scribes, and we read about them very bluntly, that they sought how they might take him by craft and put him to death. And then some of the same terminology is used, reference to Judas in verse 10 and verse 11, particularly at the end. He sought how he might conveniently betray him. What was motivating these people? What was it they were looking for? In all of that, it says in verse 2, they have this check, this caution, not on the feast day, lest there be an uproar of the people. And this would have been a bad time for them to stick their neck out and oppose this popular figure, Jesus. The time of the feast would have been a time when you'd have maybe as many as 200,000 extra people, pilgrims to Jerusalem. It would have been very hectic, a very confusing time. It could have easily led to some kind of an uprising that would have caused the Romans to take even more control, and it was then a threat to the leaders and the position that they held so closely and that they cherished so much. They were afraid, and when they were thinking about doing this, let's do it in such a way that our privileges and our position can be protected. And what's ironic is that a little bit later in chapter 15, when Pilate is interacting with them regarding Christ, verse 10 says he knew that the chief priest had delivered him because of envy. Now, what about, on the other hand, Judas? We don't have to ask what motivated him, because verse 11 tells us that when these people heard it, they were glad and promised to give him money. So whether it was an orientation for self that was clutching on to position and what I can enjoy of power and of prestige over other people, or whether it was money grubbing like Judas, these people are motivated to betrayal because they're thinking about themselves. What about, on the other hand, this woman? What is it that she does? Contrast to these people, instead of trying to take something away from Christ, her heart is to give to Jesus everything she had. And we're told something about her gift here when in verse 3 we read that she brings this box, really more of a jar, of ointment, of spikenard, very precious. And maybe you know that this nard is an oily substance that comes from a root that did not grow in Palestine, that was far away over there in India, and therefore very precious or very costly, as it says here. And it tells us, as the disciples react to what she did, they make the comment that this could have been sold for more than 300 pence or denarii. And just to give you a little bit of a sense of how much that would involve, back in chapter 6, these same men said that it would take about 200 denarii to feed 5,000 people that had gathered around Christ. And in fact, even more than that, it's pretty well known that the denarius was roughly what an average worker, what a common worker would have received as his wage for a day. You think about 300 days, which in their calendar, when you cut out the Sabbaths and other feasts, basically amounts to about a year's worth of money. Now, how much money do you suppose, when you graduate, you will make annually? According to the statistics from last year, the average entry-level salary for somebody with a liberal arts degree was about $33,258. Imagine working for a whole year and in one fell swoop just putting it all out for somebody else. It's a little hard to imagine that this woman could have made all this money and in that culture have actually saved up that much to buy this. Not really sure what all happened here, but maybe this was some kind of family heirloom that had been passed down from earlier generations and some great expenditure that had been made. Maybe don't think about money. Think about some perhaps expensive heirloom. Your family own an antique car that may be worth $30,000 or more. And again, in one fell swoop, you just give it all away to somebody without any reservations. What is driving this kind of choice? Clearly, it is a matter of love. In fact, she even breaks the neck of the bottle to get the stuff out, to pour it on Jesus. Everything, the oil, the perfume, the bottle, it is all surrendered, nothing held back. And somebody says, well, I really don't have an expensive antique. I really don't have $30,000 to give to Christ. And that's where we want to remember what it says a couple chapters earlier about that widow. In fact, the wording of the comment in verse 8, literally, what she had, she did, is almost the same as what Jesus said, reference to the widow. She of her want did cast in all that she had. The point is not the amount. The point is the sacrifice with reference to what you have that communicates the level of your commitment to the person to whom you're giving it. Now, who was this woman anyway? There are actually a couple of stories of women pouring this sort of thing on Christ. This is not the immoral woman back in chapter 7 of Luke. That's actually from a different period in the ministry of Jesus. This seems to be the same story, the same timing as what John tells us about in chapter 12 of his gospel. And when you look at that very clearly, it identifies the woman as Mary, the sister of Martha and the sister of Lazarus. This was the heart. This was the person that was making this sacrifice. Coming out of chapter 12 of John, what had just happened? This woman had just seen Jesus with just a few words raise her brother from the dead. He had been in there in the grave for 4 days. And it is in response to that of many other displays of love from Christ that this woman says, I'm going to give you the very best that I have. In fact, that whole story about the resurrection begins with this comment. Now, Jesus loved Martha and her sister, Mary, this woman, and Lazarus. And what it teaches us about discipleship is that this kind of response doesn't just happen out of nowhere. People don't just wake up in the morning and say, I'm going to give everything away to Christ. It is as they experience further and further the depths of the love of Jesus for them that their heart rises up in gratitude and worship and says, God, everything belongs to you. Number three, these responses are also different in purpose. I've already alluded to the comments of these men whose intent, their purpose was to kill. It was to destroy. It was to eliminate obstacles in their way. And what's ironic is that they're doing that in the context of the Passover season, that great time of year that celebrated God's power in rescuing Israel out of Egypt. And one of the things they did was to recall the blood that was put on the doorpost to symbolize that blood is necessary to cover for human sin and God's judgment. And it was that greed, that ambition that blinded them to the significance of death in the very ritual that they were celebrating. And their heart goes out in hostility against the one about whom all these things had been prophesying to begin with. But what was the purpose of the woman? They were focused on death. She was focused on burial. If you look with me now at verse 8, Jesus says, she has come aforehand to anoint my body to the burying. Now, I would take the words here plainly and literally to suggest that this woman knew that Jesus was going to be killed and that he was going to be buried. How would she know that? Well, this is the same Mary who sat at Jesus' feet and wouldn't get up and be busy like Martha. She is recognized for her attentiveness to the teachings of Christ. And he had, throughout his ministry, been teaching his disciples, the day is going to come, the religious leaders are going to arrest me, I'm going to go to the cross, I'm going to be buried, I'm going to rise again, and it went right over their heads. But this woman apparently got it. And perhaps of all the people that heard him teach, she was the only one who had the insight to perceive what was going to take place. And she comes in order to prepare him for that. What does this teach us about discipleship? I think that it shows us that discipleship is going to make progress as we pay close attention to what Jesus is telling us. Even if those things initially don't make a lot of sense, even if they're going to bring a lot of pain to us initially, this is the nature of discipleship. It listens attentively to the teachings of Christ. And number four, and lastly, these actions were also different in their outcome. What was the outcome of the act of betrayal? Well, look down with me at verse 11. And when they heard it, they were glad. That was the outcome. They were excited, and Judas was promised his money. And by the end of this chapter, Jesus has been arrested. By the end of the next chapter, he is dead. But appearances and immediate outcomes are not the end. We know that by the end of the book, Jesus has arisen. Within 3 days only, within about 40 years, the system of religion that these people held so dearly was going to be totally destroyed, and they would lose what they had cherished so greatly. That was the outcome for them. What was the outcome for the woman? Well, initially, again, it seems like this was not a good idea. Things not turning out well. She's rebuked by the disciples. And initially, it looks like she has just made a royal waste of something very valuable and something that could have been used for other good purposes. What is a waste to man and what looks like a waste? Listen to how Jesus describes it in verse 6. She hath wrought a good work on me. And the word good there could just as well be translated beautiful. Jesus says, this is no waste. The outcome for her is that she gets this commendation. You have done something beautiful for the Lord. And furthermore, he goes on to say, in responding to the disciples, that wherever the gospel is preached in the whole world, what she's done is going to be spoken about. And here we are 2,000 years later, and we're still talking about her. You see how the Lord, in his grace, having drawn us to discipleship, having taught us about what it demands, when we follow through in his grace, is now going to reward us in unexpected ways, perhaps. This was the outcome for her. We could say a lot more as we contrast and compare and trace this all out throughout the Gospel of Mark. But let's review. What have we learned about discipleship from this comparison of two stories? First of all, that your discipleship does not depend on your social or your religious position. Secondly, that it is about sacrifice responding to love. Thirdly, that it involves listening carefully to instruction. Fourthly, that it brings delayed, perhaps, but surprising rewards. I think we could actually summarize things even beyond that by putting this story, these two stories, in the context of the Gospel of Mark as a whole. And I take the Gospel of Mark altogether to be addressing the issue of Jesus in all of his authority as the Son of God, nevertheless becoming a servant for the benefit of us through his death. That's not just a creed to be believed, but the reason Mark tells you about that is in order to motivate you, you must live the same way. What is the theme verse of the Gospel of Mark? It is that the Son of Man came not to be ministered unto, but to minister and to give his life a ransom for many. And that is said in order to convey that that is what discipleship is all about as well. It is about not being served, but to sacrifice whatever you think is valuable for you for the benefit of your Savior and for the benefit of others that he calls you to minister to. And where this story fits in is as follows. Given that that is what Jesus did, and what kind of a radical act it was for the Son of God to act that way toward us, you really cannot be ambiguous or in the middle about how you respond to this Jesus. In other words, these really are the two and only two options to this kind of Jesus. And I would capture the message of the passage in these terms, that ultimately betrayal and devotion are the only two possible responses to Jesus Christ. Now, are you a disciple of Jesus? I don't take that for granted. I hope that you are. My challenge to you, if you are, would be this. Is this how you view life? Instead of going through life, making your decisions, well, what's going to get me ahead? Or is there any Bible verse that says I can't do this? Or what's going to be most convenient or easy? You go through life asking, in this setting, with this issue, what would be the way that I could most show love to Christ? Folks, that is the nature of discipleship. That is the kind of thinking we need to recover in the midst of a society that really has lost, and even Christian culture is losing, a sense of the antithesis between light and darkness, ultimately through life. This is our decision. What would be the way to show love to Christ? It is either betrayal or it is devotion.
You've been listening to the Chapel Hour, coming to you from the campus of Bob Jones University. Our speaker was Dr. Ken Casillas of the BJU Seminary faculty. For a cassette or compact disc copy of today's message, send a check for $6 to Campus Store, Bob Jones University, Greenville, South Carolina, 29614. Be sure to mention the name of the speaker and today's date. The Chapel Hour has been sponsored by Bob Jones University.